is 3 p.m. Well, okay, this is the last stage. This is the last word in everything. This is the last word. Yeah, as I said before, it is a beautiful day here in Charlotte, North Carolina. The sun is out, my plants are falling out of the house. And we are going to have a great show today. We have some, this is a new, as a matter of fact, this is a new one. This is a format that is the last word with the three mics. With me, I have the former Democratic chair of Mecklenburg County, Michael Evans from California, the left coast. Hello, Michael.
Good afternoon.
And I also have our favorite lawyer in Mecklenburg County, Michael Daisley.
Michael. For folks who don't know where Mecklenburg County is, that's in North Carolina, right?
Gee, they should know where Mecklenburg County is. This is the...
That's the home of Michael Lawson.
That's right. And this is the hub of all what made the Democratic Party in 2008 what it was. Because we helped North Carolina go blue. Well, I'm glad to have, and has everybody got the message here? We are the three mics. So
I'm liking it.
I like it too. Listen now, guys. Tell me, you guys are the pros involved with the Democratic Party. What is the state of the Democratic Party right now? And Michael Evans, on the left coast, give us what you think.
Well, I don't know about being called a pro. That makes me sound like I'm part of the professional left. But I think the Democratic Party right now is in particularly good shape. You know, you look at the Republicans, they're engaged in a war on women, a war on poor people, even really a war on the middle class, because they want them to finance tax cuts for the well-to-do, a war on immigrants. They're simply destroying every potential voter base there is out there, and the Democrats just have to be in a position to take advantage of this.
Well, you know, well, Mike, what do you think?
From the right side, I see it the same way, although I should say the right coast. North Carolina is going to be a huge battleground, I think, and a very important one. And what I've told folks, and I haven't seen anything to think differently on this, that while it would be great for the president to repeat and keep North Carolina blue in 2012, there are a number of scenarios that Obama can get to 270 without necessarily winning North Carolina. I don't see any realistic scenario that Romney can get to 270 without carrying North Carolina.
Right.
And so that's what makes this key, that if Obama wins here, I do not see any scenario that Romney can pull in other votes from other states without carrying North Carolina. I mean, he has to run the table on all the other states where, you know, folks are leaning one way or the other, and he's got to have a solid South, and that's a little bit problematic for him because, again, he still has his problems with conservatives. It's clear that they don't love him. And you see it right now just this week, now that it clearly is going to be his nomination and Santorum's out of the race, he is tap dancing, trying to appeal to women, which he knows he has to do, and yet not alienate conservatives. And that's a very, very, very tough tap dance to try and do.
And he is no Fred Astaire. The problem is now see,
all,
and the, go ahead, what do you say?
Oh, although his wife did say the other day that he was not stiff.
That's right.
That's right.
Well, that's a different story. I mean, we haven't gotten into abortion yet, so when we get there, we'll talk about that. But here's the thing that I wanted to know about is that you were saying you couldn't see really a way that Romney could get to 270. Now, North Carolina, this isn't like the primaries. It's a winner take all, isn't that correct?
Oh yeah, in every state. Well, I think in every state except Michael, there's Kansas or Oklahoma. What states split their electoral votes?
I believe it is only one. Some other states have considered it, but I think only one does so at the current time.
Right. And how many votes do we have in North Carolina?
It's 13. Or is it 15? 15, excuse me. That's right. 13 congressional districts and two senators, and that's how it goes. You take your representatives and you take your senators and add them together, and that's your electoral votes.
Now you see, what we're going to be known as, I am ML, and you are MD, and Michael Evans is ME.
There you go.
Okay.
See, and we're not talking about medical examiner either. So, but the thing
it's
is...
It's all about me. Go ahead.
Right. It's all about me. Now, see, you're talking like he's Newt Gingrich or something. But anyway.
No. I meant when I said all about me, that's ME, all about Michael Evans. That's what I meant.
Right. Well, you see, now, what you are saying is so true. Now, I've heard from a lot of Democrats, insiders, who are telling me the Democratic Party has given up on North Carolina. And they have pulled out all their people because they don't feel that they can win North Carolina. Now, I just do not see that at all.
I certainly don't see that on the ground. They've opened up, Michael, you know better than I would. How many offices has Obama opened here? I want to say five or six in the state.
Absolutely. And you know, the thing is that he got at least, I believe, 95% of the African-American vote or 93% of the African-American vote and when he ran the last time, and there is no reason for him not to get that now?
It's a matter of turnout, I think. California is going to be solidly blue, I would think. Isn't that right?
Yeah, certainly for the president. The campaign isn't going to spend a dime here. They're going to use California as an ATM.
Well, you know, the thing is that now I have a problem with the overall look, and I have been trying to tell people as the first vice chair for the 8th Congressional District, which is now almost defunct because of the redistricting. They took 33 precincts out of the total of 36 in the 8th District and put them into Mel Watt's 12th District, trying to get Larry Kissel out of office. But that's a lot of inside politics that a lot of people don't understand. We'll go into that on future shows. But one of the things that I was trying to tell people that we are in the position we are right now, yes, because Obama has done quite a few good things and achievements. I mean, the Affordable Care Act, he ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He stopped defending DOMA, Dodd-Frank financial reform, Lilly Ledbetter, Consumer Financial Protection Act, the end of the war in Iraq. He got Osama bin Laden. He created the structure for getting Gaddafi. He saved the American auto industry, just to say a few things. But the president cannot pass laws. And what I have been trying to tell people is that they need to worry about who's in their boards, who's on their boards of education, who's on their city county commissioners and state and then state federal representative House and Senate, because they're the ones that make these laws. The president just signs them. So it really doesn't matter realistically in the long range thing to get people back to work who is president, because if we control the Congress and the Senate, we can get anything we want as long as we have a veto-proof number.
I don't know. You're exactly right, Michael, but I don't see, you know, we can keep the Senate. We might even take the House. I don't see taking the Senate with a veto-proof majority. What is going to be absolutely necessary at some point in the game is some collaboration and some compromise. That is, in fact, the art of governing, and that seems to me what has been lost more than anything. One can point fingers all day long as to why that is, but I think, you know, up and down the ballot, you're exactly right, that it's not just all about the White House. That's the one that gets the most attention. But it clearly is not. That's clearly not what it's all about.
Right. Well, I went to a forum a couple of days ago, I believe it was on Monday, and all the candidates are running for, well, most of the candidates are running for lieutenant governor, judges, and one of the, that's what I spoke to them about. I said, you people in this room are the cogs that make the machine roll, make the car roll. And people, you know, to me, we need to start training people. And why doesn't the parties stress training about how to vote, that we need to vote from the bottom up? Because if we don't vote from the bottom up, about 40% of the people leave and never even vote for the judges. Never. Because they're on a separate sheet of paper. And the district judges affect our lives more than any person on this planet. Every day.
Well, they do. And, of course, the whole notion about whether to elect judges is a whole other issue. I mean, we do that in North Carolina, and they do it in most states. But what you're suggesting, Michael Lawson, then, is to sort of turn the ballot upside down so that the first thing that you would vote for are the, the smaller offices.
Absolutely correct.
City council up. All right, I see.
Would that take a governor's approval, or is that something that's done with the Board of Election?
Michael, what do you think? I think you. I don't know of any law that requires the presidential ballot to be the first thing that somebody sees and acts on. I just don't know of any law like that. I don't know that, frankly, any board of elections would ever do that. But I don't know that there's anything preventing them.
It's certainly custom, and I'm sure the state legislature could say we want the ballot positioned in a different way. But that's an interesting suggestion.
But why wouldn't they do it? Because they don't want themselves to be the first, but yet they'd run for governor in a micro minute. I don't understand that. You know, it'd be because isn't the idea to have people vote? And we'll get to what they're doing now, but isn't the idea is to have people vote for representation?
Well, you certainly want everybody to be voting, but there's also an element here of voter education, and that's an area that I think the Democratic Party in particular needs to do a lot of work in. What we find here, particularly when we register new voters, and particularly new voters in immigrant communities, they really do not have a clear understanding of what goes on in the electoral process at all. So not only are you having to educate on a candidate or an issue, you're having to educate on the process itself. And with less and less emphasis on civics education at the high school level now, I think we're probably going to be seeing more and more of that. And we have to be positioned to address it.
Well, I was making this point a couple of weeks ago on one of my shows, and I said that, everybody, it's so difficult today because what the kids in junior year in high school had to learn is everything that I learned all the way through high school, plus everything new that came out of high school after I graduated. And they still have this, they have to learn it in the same amount of time and the same amount of hours. And the only thing they took out of the course is physical education and some sort of art program, which was also mandatory when I graduated. So they're expecting these, our children, to learn everything that came before me, up to me, and everything that came after me in school in the same amount of time and the same amount of hours. Now, this doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure you can't do that, especially when you now have new programs, the computer, that they all have to learn.
Well, and especially considering how long you've been around, Michael. Do you go back to the pyramids? I mean, seriously.
I did have a talk with, King Tut at one time, but
I hear you. On a serious level, yeah, civic education is one that is frankly lacking. But there's so many issues here. What I'll put on the table, and what you and I have spoken about before, Michael, and I'd be really interesting to see if any listeners, might have the same challenge in their area, and you spoke about it just a little while ago, Michael, in terms of the 8th District of North Carolina that you're the party chair for, and how the North Carolina legislature arranged to have precincts, Democratic precincts, carved out of the 8th District and put into a district that is already heavily Democratic.
Right.
We call that process packing.
Yeah.
And they did a phenomenal job at that this year, so that the three Democratic districts are far more Democratic than they were before. Right?
Absolutely.
And that leaves, of course, the other districts to be more Republican, being able to share the remaining Republican voters,
right.
and so that the Democrats win big, and the Republicans win small,
mm-hmm.
but then more Republicans win, right?
Right.
And so here's what I'm getting to with all that is, this is all done under the guise of the Voting Rights Act, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And whether, if you are a district representative, and whether it's a member of Congress, whether you are a member of city council in Oakland, California, or you're on the county commission in Namer County in Illinois, or you are in the state house in Virginia, anytime you are a district representative in this country, it is far more likely than not that you come from a protected district, right? So that once you become an incumbent, you stay an incumbent. You are in a protected district. And my question that I just put out for discussion is, has the Voting Rights Act outlived its usefulness? Is the cost that is borne by this type of gerrymandering worth the benefit from it? And I'm not smart enough to answer that question, but I do think it's a fair question.
You're absolutely correct. The question is, now, is it because the Act has what we have now has outgrown the Act, or is it that the people are misusing the Act?
Well, and I was on a panel discussion here at the Charlotte School of Law not too long ago, and I felt like I was the who's he in the midst of the who's who. We had some folks there was from D.C., there was from the Heritage Foundation was in on the conservative side. We had some folks from ACLU, and somehow I was the local guy. And one of the spokespersons from down in Atlanta said, she said, Michael, which was, is it the misuse of the Act?
Right.
And to me, and you don't normally hear this coming from a Democrat, it strikes me that that type of logic is very similar to the type of logic that says, well, guns don't kill people, people kill people, right?
Well.
It is the use of the instrument, all right? And you're right, it's the use of the Act, but the Act allows the type of procedures that you're seeing, and it's not just in North Carolina, it's all across the country.
Well, it's just like stand your ground.
Yeah, and it is in the sense that you have a legislature on its whim going ahead and passing laws that in retrospect may not be so smart. In this case, what the Republicans did in North Carolina with, without really much shame about it at all, was to carve up, counties have long since been carved up. Natural geographic boundaries within the counties are carved up. This year, they have carved up precincts in an unprecedented rate. There were some split precincts before, so that if you were in precinct, 42, for instance, you were in House District X or Y. It was one or the other. Right. And only a few precincts were split. The number of split precincts under this Republican scheme has more than doubled. Right, and just in Mecklenburg County alone, and it's true for all 100 counties in North Carolina. So that if you say that, I live in precinct such and such, you don't have any real confidence to be able to say who your representative is. They've carved up that much. There's a sort of joke to say, well, whose district are you in? That you would answer, what side of the bed do you sleep on, right? And that'll tell you what district you're in. It's almost gotten that fine-tuned.
It is that right now, because as the 8th District first vice chair, I just got my new voter registration card. It says I'm in the 12th District now. But yet the Democratic Party wants me to go to the 8th District Convention. And I've gotten 40 calls, at least 40 calls in the last 2 weeks from people, because they're getting their new voter registration cards. They do not know where to go, and nobody has told them.
Right. Right. And so my question comes back again to, again, this is the question I put on the table.
Right.
Is the interpretation of the Voting Rights Act, right, something that is good for democracy? That's the question.
Okay.
Right?
But
I think local people have different answers for it. But, I mean, you know, and frankly, it is a question, Michael, that, frankly, I'm not sure, just to put it out there, that the white community can answer. That has got to come from the protected communities.
Right. Well, but you're saying now the interpretation, or are you saying that you believe that the act may have lived itself?
Well, I guess in a way I'm saying more the interpretation of it, but unless you take the instrument away, then the party in power is likely to interpret it in such a way that benefits it. You know, and of course now the Republicans are saying in Raleigh, they have for the last 2 years, well, the Democrats have done the same thing, and that is true only in this respect. It's like saying, well, both sides are guilty of speeding. When the Democrats, in fact, maybe set their cruise control to 75, you know, maybe 80 miles an hour, you know, it's going up pretty fast. The Democrats are pretty good at drawing districts. The Republicans have come out of a, you know, a bar sloshed and go 90 miles an hour down Main Street. Right? Both are guilty of speeding.
Right.
But to say that, oh gosh, they're equal in degree just defies the facts.
Right.
But nonetheless, it is a topic that you look at, and it's difficult, and it divides Democrats. I mean, back when the Democrats had the majority, I had discussions frequently,
right,
and I posed the question to office holders up there. And good people. And when I asked the question, I was asking it like I just asked it. You know, is it fair to ask whether or not the law should be looked at and the law should be revised?
Right.
Right. But the question becomes not that so much. I mean, I can ask that question. Here's the question they hear. Gee. Representative Smith, can you make it easier? Can you make it harder for you to get reelected? Will you work with me to make it harder for you to be reelected?
Yeah.
That's what they hear. And of course, they don't want any part of that.
You're right. So the thing is, the reason why I think it's being interpreted this way, and what I'm trying to surmise what you're saying is that it's all about me. When these guys get into office, it's not about what's good for the masses. It's what's good about me. Does the need of the many outweigh the need of the few, or does the need of the few outweigh the need of the many? I mean,
I wouldn't be that cynical across the board. I would say when it comes to redistricting, mm-hmm. There's a lot of that element. I know many, many, many good Democrats who are just fine with the system, or were just fine with the system, because they had a pretty cushy district, right? They were just, and they were great on all these other issues, but not so great on the issue of redistricting, in my view. Because again, it's pretty clear where I come down from.
Right.
I would just as soon have a commission appointed. I would just as soon take incumbency out of the equation. I'd just as soon take race out of the equation, and to draw districts that were compact, that were based on geographic boundaries, and that would allow a fair fight. Because frankly, I think that benefits Democrats. We win on the issues.
But didn't they in the past have judges that drew the lines?
When it got to court, yes. When it got to the court, yes, you would have judges that could overturn based on the law. But the Supreme Court has you know, had a number of cases that, in essence, come down to this. It comes down that says, look, you can't draw lines where race is the predominant factor. We will strike that down.
Right.
However, if you come to us and it's explicit that what you were trying to do, and you say it all throughout your legislation history, we're going to protect incumbents. We are going to make it really, really, really hard for any challenger to win. And that's what our goal is.
Right.
The Supreme Court will say, hey, we're not saying that's a good idea. We're just saying it's not unconstitutional. If you want to do that, state of X, go ahead. All right? And that's where the Supreme Court comes down. You know, and so states are free now to come in and draw districts that, you know, may have all kinds of racial characteristics
right.
to it.
Right.
But if they can go, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, oh, it's not about race, it's about protecting the incumbent.
Right.
Then that gives them a wide discretion to do what you're seeing in North Carolina and various other places. Michael, I don't know how it's working out in California. And, again, I know it's a blue state for the president, but, boy, it's a big state, and you got lots of districts to draw, and there are lots of protected districts out there, I'm thinking.
Well, you're right, but I got to see
right.
right now that we had a good explanation of the law here. Now, the political side of it, Mr. M.E., how do you – answer what Mr. MD was just saying.
Well, first let me address the question he had regarding the Voting Rights Act. We actually have four counties in out of 58 in California that are directly affected by the Voting Rights Act. Two of those counties happen to be adjacent to Fresno County, which is where I live, and therefore are directly affected by redistricting in our area. And any redistricting within those counties has to be approved by the Department of Justice. And in one of those counties, the population has evolved over time such that it being a restricted county has actually diminished the overall input of the minority population in the county and elections there. So the first thing I would say is the areas that are affected by the Voting Rights Act need to be revisited. And then the second thing is that the real issue now is these voter suppression tactics that are being used in various states. And I think that in any sort of revision or reworking of the Voting Rights Act is probably what needs to be addressed. As for redistricting, we actually had a proposition that was passed, well, two propositions that affected how redistricting is done in the state of California.
Mm-hmm.
And a commission was set up that had five Democratic members, five Republican members, and four not affiliated with either of those two parties.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a very long and drawn-out process to actually get to the 14 people that served. If you worked on campaigns or you worked with parties, you weren't eligible. And then they had eight or nine criteria that they had to deal with. Some of them were criteria that were directed by law, but others were they could not factor in incumbency, and they had to be compact districts, they had to be contiguous districts, and then this commission went through the state. They did about 12 to 14 hearings throughout the state to get input on communities of interest and maintaining those communities of interest within districts and to get knowledge on how to go about setting up the districts themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, they developed a first set of maps, and then they did a second round of hearings to get input on the maps that they had created. I was initially opposed to this process because you had an equal number of Republicans and Democrats on the commission, and that simply is not reflective of our the registration in our state. But as it played out, it was a far, far more open process than they had ever seen here before, and probably ever been anywhere for a redistricting process. And there were some minor disputes at the end. The Republican Party did challenge the state Senate districts in court, but to no avail. And it was the Republican Party that actually introduced the propositions initially to form the commission.
Mm-hmm.
So this, all in all, worked out to be extremely fair and effective. And you know, in my particular part of the state, which tends to be redder than the coastal areas, you know, we ended up with more Republicans than Democrats. But that probably is reflective of the population and shows the work that we have ahead of us.
Right. Well, but see, but how are you able to sit there and sit down with people who were not diametrically opposed to you because you had the letter D on your shirt? I mean, you know, this is what we're getting with most of these places. They don't even want to sit down with anybody that has a D on their shirt. Michael?
Yeah, well, you know, that's the matter of, you know, what Mike was talking about earlier was we do need to sit down to the table. We have to have the dialogue, and we have to realize that compromise is a reality of political life, not the ultimate sin.
Well, you know, but before, I know you got to go, Michael D., but I wanted to ask you a question about the politics here in Mecklenburg County. How can we get this county back in the frame of mind of supporting each other?
You mean you're talking about Democrats in there or just everybody
I'm
in
talking about
together?
Democrats. I'm talking about Democrats.
I don't know that the schism is as wide as folks think it is.
Okay.
Let me ask you. I'll put the question back to you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is causing the schism?
I think I'm coming from New York. So, and in New York, everything, the five boroughs of New York, not Albany. I'm talking about metropolitan New York City, five boroughs, you know, which is probably more, they have more people in one block than they got in this whole state. You know, but I came from a region where there was East Elmhurst, where it was 95% registered and, or 99% registered and 95% voted. I mean, Indian Trail, let's take that for instance. 2010, 33,000 people in Indian Trail, 2,000 voted. Now, how do 31,000 people not hear about the vote?
Well, I go back and I'm going to beat that same drum. But it goes back again in many ways to what I'm saying about redistricting. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear about, oh gosh, your vote will make all the difference. Your vote will make difference. You go ahead and turn out. It's important. Well, in plain fact of the matter, in the majority of districts, again, whether you're talking about city council, county commission, anything else, it doesn't matter because, you know, the districts are drawn in such a lopsided fashion that there's no real reason to get out. Couple that with the fact of what we just talked about, that now so many precincts are split that, you know, you can be with your neighbor.
That's right.
If you are a citizen-oriented person and you're actually talking about public affairs and you're talking about your representative in the state house or the state senate or on, you know, city council,
right.
Let's leave it the state house since we're talking about the different districts for the legislature, state house, state senate, and you're actually talking about that with your neighbor, and you guys vote in the same place. Well, we need to get our district representative, Mr. Smith, blah, 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 and your neighbor from just around the corner. Mm-hmm. He's not our representative. Mrs. Yeah. Jones is.
Right.
And it's because they've split the precinct. And so nobody knows who their representative is anymore. And so the whole way that it is framed, the whole way that it is structured, Michael, is designed in such a fashion that dialogue and compromise is not really possible. And it's also designed so that voters are not particularly inspired to get out because the district is drawn so lopsided one way or the other, their votes don't really matter. So, again, I go back to put the question on the table.
Mm-hmm.
That's the price we pay. That's the cost we have for having the Voting Rights Act. Is the benefit that comes from it worth it? And, you know, that depends on who you ask.
Well, we don't. One other thing before that, I want to ask you because I know your time is short. What about consolidation in
Between Charlotte and Mecklenburg?
Yes.
Between Charlotte and Mecklenburg, I think that is something that is on its way, mainly because we've got an African American mayor who is, you know, getting to be more and more nationally recognized, and certainly will be once the Democrats come to visit here nationally here in August and September, but who's in favor of it. And I think he will continue to sort of push in that direction and find and collect support for it. It's not an easy thing. It's something that it'll be a long time in implementing, but clearly the city of Charlotte and the county of Mecklenburg, it is becoming more and more a single unit from a practical standpoint with each passing year, maybe even with each passing week. So, I think it's certainly inevitable. Whether it's inevitable in 2013 or 2023, I can't say. But within our lifetimes, I certainly think we'll see it. And it's just a matter of how that's going to be structured and when it gets implemented, and just how strong Anthony Fox wants to push it, because I think that's the direction that we're heading.
And the you direction think it's a good idea, though. But what is your idea about it?
I think it has a lot of opportunity for a lot of savings, in other words, and also again, this is one that will, I think, invoke better citizen involvement because people will know where to go.
Right.
You and I know where to go because we pay attention to these things.
Right.
And that generally speaking, the city sort of is bricks and mortar and street lights and police and that sort of stuff. And the county is more health and human services and helping to fund the school system and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But to have that stuff consolidated, I think certainly helps. And so that's the direction that we're heading in. Unfortunately, the direction that I've got to be heading in is back to taking care of this one client that I've got to get back to here by 4 o'clock. Hey, this has been great. Let's do it again here. Y'all continue the conversation.
Thank you.
Obviously, but I'm going to hang up, and then you guys can talk about me once I'm gone.
Okay, yeah, we will.
All right, please.
Okay.
All right, talk to you later. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
All right, take care. Right, bye-bye.
I'd like to follow up on the consolidation, because I think, not speaking specifically to Mecklenburg, but just in general, I think consolidation of governments is essential at this time. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the budget crisis that are occurring throughout the country, we really need to start looking at ways to make our government more cost-effective and more efficient.
Right.
And the way government's created initially, you know, they organically created in a small town or in counties or, for example, in my county, Fresno County, there are 37 school districts
mm-hmm.
in a county that has a smaller population than Mecklenburg County, which has one school district.
Right.
So I think there are definitely some efficiencies, and as Mike was suggesting, that the people would be closer to the representatives and their representatives would be more responsive under a certain kind of consolidation.
And just look at county government, for example. You know, in North Carolina, you have 100 counties. In California, we have 58 in a much larger geographic area.
Oh, I mean, now,
all of those counties have separate governments.
Listen, but how is that even possible that they only have 58 counties in all of California? That is incredible.
Well, I think really the oddity here is North Carolina. It's unusual for a state to have that many for its size.
Oh, okay. So we got the shoes on the wrong feet.
Right.
Well, you know, the thing is that are we talking about Los Angeles is a county by itself. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Now, and how many people do they have in Los Angeles? What, 7 million?
Well, there's like, 4 or 5 billion people. But you really can't extrapolate from Los Angeles County to anywhere else.
Right.
There are 87 municipalities in Los Angeles County.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, the registrar there, you know, pretty much has an election going on all the time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you see, that's it's bad enough coming from a city like New York where everything is, you know, vertical and horizontal. You know where this person is in this electoral district. You know, this person is in this precinct. And the lines aren't, you know, jagged. They're pretty square. I mean, you know, it's not no like it here is in Mecklenburg County. So the thing is, in Los Angeles, they how are they drawn? I mean, is it the same way or is it jagged?
I really don't know the specifics about how they do it, but you're talking about a much larger geographic area. You know, you're talking, as I said, 87 different municipalities.
Mm-hmm.
Probably your precincts are going to be confined within municipalities. So, in New York, and particularly in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, et cetera, you're talking a much more compact area.
Right.
That by and large hasn't significantly changed for decades.
Right, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. Moving off this just for a minute, because I have the MSNBC on as I'm watching this also, and they've been playing. What the heck is wrong with these? I don't use the word Republican. They're the regressive party. How do they expect to throw women under the bus and expect to win an election? I mean, why have they gone back to an issue that was supposed to be taken care of 40 years ago, the abortion issue? What is the purpose of them bringing that up when their sole purpose was to win?
Well, I have an odd take on this, and I think it is a result of their success. And what I mean by this is, of course, we all know that after the Goldwater loss, the Goldwater landslide loss in 1964, that conservative Republicans started getting together and developing a plan to take over, which eventually culminated with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980.
Right.
What they initially set out to do, they have by and large accomplished.
Yeah, well.
They haven't yet privatized security, and I'm not even sure that was one of the initial tenets. That may have come about over time as well. And they haven't completely destroyed government. And even initially, they probably weren't thinking about destroying the government the way today's Republicans are thinking about destroying government.
Absolutely.
So I think the unbelievable success of their movement, and even getting, to some extent, Democrats to buy into it, looking at the more conservative aspects of what the Clinton administration did, has emboldened them to think, we can take this even further. While at the same time, they were bringing in these individuals with a much more radical mindset than the types of folks that were engaged in this discussion in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And but with this empowerment and their radicalism, they don't view this as problematic. They think they have it's part of the agenda they should be trying to achieve.
Well, yeah, but you see, I have a slightly different view on that. I think that they brought these people into the party, the Bob Michaels and the and these other truly Republicans. I will call them Republicans because the people that are in there now are the aggressive wing of the party. What they rode the tiger and thought they could control the tiger, and now the tiger is looking in their face because there's no more food and is now looking at them to eat. Now, have you seen the commercial with the Geico commercial, I believe it is, where the two people are sitting in bed and the leopard is sitting on top of the dresser licking his chops, looking at them, waiting to go to sleep? Oh, no, it was for ADT, I believe. And they don't have to sleep at night because they bought a rescue leopard.
Right.
And they're sleeping, and he said, we don't have to sleep at night. I'm not tired anymore. We can keep our eyes open all night. Because if they go to sleep, the tiger's going to eat them. So this is the same thing here. I think they wanted to get, they brought in these wild animals, and these wild animals, they thought they could control them if they gave them enough food so they could have them on their side, because the Republican Party lost ideas after the Goldwater debacle. And they needed new ideas, and they got the new ideas from the first leopard, who was now the Pillsbury Doughboy, Newt Gingrich. And they have now brought in so many leopards, they have lost control of them. And the leopards are now eating their young and eating their parents. And pretty soon there'll be nothing left, so they will eat each other. And I believe this is, it's the take that you have presented, but I do not believe they thought that it would ever happen this way. I believe they thought that they could control whichever leopard they brought into their party. They now lost control.
Yeah, well, I think you're right about that. And the fact that, in the 2008 election, they did not have somebody they could control. You know, and right. McCain, at least at that time,
right.
was not a puppet for the conservative establishment within the party.
That's right.
And so that was one of the reasons, they weren't as enthusiastic about it.
Well,
and I don't think they viewed Romney as a puppet of the conservative establishment.
That's my next question. I mean, is Romney viewed more on their side than McCain was?
Well, certainly Romney has made more of an effort to sound like a conservative Democrat than McCain did during the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Now, post-campaign, obviously McCain's become exactly what they've wanted him to be, but he wasn't that during the election. And but Romney, he's in a difficult position now. You know, when he looks to fill the vice presidential slot, does he choose someone who has bona fides with the right wing, the radical right, or does he choose someone that might give him some legitimacy with independent voters?
Mm-hmm.
And this is an important question for Democrats, too, because if he somehow is able to engage the radical right, that increases their the likelihood that they will turn out and the likelihood that they can keep control of Congress.
Well, but you see, between Romney and McCain, I don't think he was an open book. Romney blows with the wind. He hasn't had a position more than 15 minutes at any time during this entire primary season.
Well, that's true. And there has been lots of opportunity for people to learn about that as the Republicans have gone after him on that same issue.
Mm-hmm.
But now that he is the nominee, we're not going to see any more of this critical viewpoints of Romney from the media. I mean, we were getting that because the Republicans were doing it. So now it's either Obama makes the case or the case won't get made.
So what you're saying is that because the Progressive Party didn't want Romney, they were making a case against him. Now that he's the inevitable, they're going to make a case for him and not against him. But the problem is, isn't the seed already planted? Isn't the acorn in the ground already?
Well, I mean, it's certainly going to be difficult for some of these people who have said such negative things about Romney to go have lunch with him and sort of put it all behind them. But then again, you know, attorneys do that every day. And,
Mike
and
is gone.
You know, there was a certain amount of it that had to occur between Obama folks and Clinton folks.
Yes, but you know, here's the thing. No, I see, and I've heard that said before. Well, the Obama and Clinton really had, they were, but you know, the problem was the only thing they beat up each other on was experience. You know, and everybody in the Democratic Party liked both of them. In the Republican Party, everybody doesn't like Romney.
Right, but the other side of this, too, is even though it was a Romney person who brought up the Etch-a-Sketch analogy,
right,
it essentially applies to all of them.
Of course.
Yeah, they'll all deny what they said and move forward as to what benefits them most.
Well, yeah, you know, you believe me or your lying eyes. I mean, or your lying ears. That's true. I mean, that's politics. The problem is you need to call them on it when they do it. But, you know, it's just like who was the guy? Goebbels said, hey, just keep telling the lie. Tell the lie, you'll tell it so long, people will think it's true. I mean,
and they did that. They did that
they
with
did.
This whole idea of a liberal media.
Yes.
I mean, that's one of the most successful hoaxes of the last century.
Yeah. And what does a liberal media mean? I mean, what does that mean? They just throw out words. It's just like this fool West, Alan West. There are 78 to 81. He was specific. He didn't say 75 or 80. He said 78. I guess, and when you say even and odd numbers, I guess that's going to make people believe what you're saying. 78 to 81 communists in the Democratic Party. And they said, oh, well, you know, I mean the Progressive Party later. Well, gee whiz, that's still part of the Democratic Party. I mean,
right.
Well, why does he think that in 2012, he could say the same thing that Joe McCarthy said in the 50s?
Well, unfortunately, I think this is one area where cable news comes into play.
Yeah.
You know, if we didn't have a 24-hour cable cycle, I think what Alan West said would have quickly gotten, shoved under the rug.
Well, it might not have even been heard.
All rational people know that it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But with the cable cycle, you know, it's going to be out there for at least a week. And, people are going to be responding to it. And because he's the kind of person he is, he's not going to back down. And he'll probably stick his foot in his mouth three or four more times trying to alter what he actually meant to say.
He says here, as many as 80 House Democrats are communists, he said, and he warned at a town hall meeting, I've heard dozens of Democratic colleagues in the House say to me that they're communists. I said, the Communist Party has publicly referred to the Progressive Caucus as its allies. Well, now, he's saying the Communist Party is saying this, but he's saying that he heard that the Democrats were. See, so now he tries to step back from it and says, it wasn't me that was saying it, it was the Communist Party that was saying it. And if he doesn't like the Communist Party, and like he says he doesn't, why is he repeating anything they say?
Right. Well, it's incumbent on us to just make sure that people understand this is complete and utter nonsense.
Oh, well, you know, that's that. Now, Mitch, I'm sure you saw the film Wall Street with
yes.
Michael Douglas, Academy Award performance. And Gordon Gekko's great line in that, greed is good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mitt Romney says that he's a job creator. In the film, Michael Douglas says, Gordon Gekko, I'm a destroyer of jobs. Now, Mitt Romney and Gordon Gekko are relatively the same person. The same exact thing. Bain Capital, the whole idea with Bain Capital was, is to go in to companies that were on the border of collapsing and giving them a flux of money to help them support themselves, and taking his money out that he put in plus a percentage. But the problem is, when he put the money into the company, there were other things that went along with that. They had to cut staff here. They had to cut staff here. And then when the company couldn't make it without the staff, he said, well, there's nothing more I can do. And he took his money that he put in out, plus his percentage that he made out, and now the company had no equity left in the company, and the company failed. Now, this had this happened almost 7 out of 10 times. But now there are a few companies that did make it, that were able to stand on their feet and make it. But most companies, when Bain Capital came in to rescue you, they were on the way out the door, 1 foot in the grave, and they did not make it back. So why is this person who is supposed to be, who says he is the money person, I can bring this country back. Well, wait a minute. We are coming back. It was 6,000 and change, 6,200 or 6,300, the Dow Jones, when this president came in office. It's now 13,000. I mean, what? That would have happened anyway, he's saying? I mean, why do people believe this man is the, and this is his only out. He's not going to tell us about military power. He's not going to tell us about anything he did with, well, he can tell us about health insurance, but he's not going to say about anything else. So why do people believe this man?
Well, certainly Romney has real issues when he talks about the economy. He tries to sell the idea that because of his business background, that gives him some sort of insight into a successful American economy that the rest of us don't have.
Right.
But then he embraces all of these right-wing, what one of their own called mm-hmm. voodoo economics. He embraces that. He embraces the Ryan budget, even though it's full of holes and doesn't address the revenue aspects of the budget effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And his the whole vision that he seems to put forth is, because I was in business, you should trust me. And the complete unwillingness of Romney and all Republicans to recognize that there is a role for government.
Mm-hmm. What happened? We lost our thing here. What happened? Whoops. Hello? Who's online? 1, 2. Okay. I must have lost Mr. Evans. Hello? I guess I don't know if I'm on the line or not. Let's see here. Well, I just lost Mr. Evans. Let's see if we can get him back here. Let's see here. Yes. Okay. I see him. Where is he at here? Let's see. Let me bring up the voice here. I don't know what happened here. But we lost him. Okay. Hello.